November 12, 1962, Magnetostatics. Lecture S13, November 12, 1962, Magnetostatics. Lecture S13, November 12, 1962, Magnetostatics.
Surprisingly enough, the force on a charge depends not only on where it is, but also on how fast it's moving. It's necessary to describe two quantities in order to specify at a given point in space, to specify two quantities, two vector quantities at a given point in space, to fully determine the force on any charge. First, the electric field, which is the force that would be on it if it were not moving. And second, the correction, which is proportional to the velocity, determined by another coefficient called the magnetic field. Magnetic field is very strange in its relationship, in its directional relationships, and I would like to repeat a number of the demonstrations which have been given in the first year and also earlier this year to show you some of those points. The first thing is that we have here a tube with a beam of electrons which goes straight down. And what's the matter? Huh? Oh, X-rays. You've been reading too many propaganda things. Now, at the end, you see the spot where the electrons have collided. If I put up a magnetic field with a bar magnet here, you see that the electrons are deflected up, which is a very peculiar thing. You put the magnet this way, and the electrons go up. If I turn the magnet over, could I have a little bit of light so you can see what I'm doing with the magnet? If I turn the magnet over, the electrons go down. If I move the same magnet to here, they go sideways. The directions are very peculiar. We'll explain where the directions come from in a minute. Can I have the lights, please? Lights, sir? Thank you, sir. No more X-rays. You're all right now. You live through it. Now, the strange feature is that by holding up a magnet here, we get a force which is at right angles to the magnet, to the direction of the magnet, in a sense, and to the velocity of the electrons. And if we represent the character of the magnet by imagining a field here, which we call the magnetic field, then we'll have to imagine that the magnetic field is in the opposite sign on the other side of the magnet. So that when I turn it over, I change the sign of the magnetic field. And we can represent the whole thing by saying that the force on a charge is the cross product between the velocity and the magnetic field. So the general rule for the force on moving charges is given by this law. And this is what we'll use to define the meaning of a magnetic field. It can be found by testing the force on a moving charge, moving in various directions, and find out what the B has to be to account for the motion in any case. Now, it's true for any moving charge, moving under any circumstance, that this is the force. And the first thing we'd like to be able to understand is the force that's produced on wires carrying currents and so on. So there'll be a short discussion of what is meant by current density. If we have electrons drifting around in some material or other charges moving, then there's a flow of electrical charge from one point to another. And if we set up an arbitrary area, a unit area, or an infinitesimal area, say, in a given place, then there's a certain amount of charge which flows across that area per second. We can represent, just as we could in the case of heat flow, represent by a vector the amount of charge which passes per unit area per second. This vector J is J, and is the charge which passes a unit area per second. But it has a direction, and it's a direction of the motion of the charges. Another way to put it, however, is this, that if you set up an area, let's say, perpendicular to the x-axis, then J sub x is the charge passing per unit area perpendicular to the x-axis per second. Then J sub n is the amount that passes a surface set at the angle n. Let's take an example. Suppose that we have an object of some kind which carries a certain charge density, which may or may not be a function of position inside, and that the whole object is drifting, say, in x direction exactly, with a common velocity v. Then what is the current? If we set up the current is in the direction of v, because that's the direction of the motion right away. Another way to notice that is if we put up an area this way, horizontally, no charge flows through it. So there's no component of J in any direction except the x direction. And if I put a unit area here and wait an infinitesimal time delta t, how much charge moves? In an infinitesimal time delta t, this crazy shaped thing will be moved by a distance v delta t. And all of the charge which was in a little piece of it, which is v delta t thick, will have moved through. So the amount that moves through per delta t is rho v. So under such circumstances, the current density is the charge density multiplied by the velocity vector. If we have another circumstance, for instance, if we have a lot of electrons in a box, say n per cubic centimeter, and each carries a charge q electron, and they're drifting, or their mean motion has a velocity v, then n q electron v is also the current density. Can be seen several ways. N times v is the number of particles which pass through the surface per second, times the charge is the charge carried. Charge on each particle. It's not necessarily electrons. It's a charge on each particle. Or if you wish, nq times the particle, the number of particles times the charge on each is the charge density. And the charge density times the velocity is the current as previously explained, and so on. Since this is true, the amount of electricity which passes through a surface area, dA, is the component of J in a direction dA. And if I integrate this over a complete closed surface, I find the charge which leaves the surface, or flowing through the surface, charge which leaving a volume which is enclosed by the surface per second, on a closed surface. Now, one of the laws of electricity is that the charges are never lost. They are conserved. You can't make them. You can't lose them. They're always, if you get them, you can only move them from one place to the other. So the only way the charge can leave the volume is that the total amount of charge inside the volume, if Q is the charge inside the volume, it changes with time with a decrease given by the flux of J through the surface. This is an example of a conservation law. And finally, one more result. If we take for the surface an infinitesimal cube, then the flow out of the cube is the divergence of J per unit volume. And the amount of charge in the cube is the charge density at the, and so that is the same law as the other one, only in differential form. This is another one of those conservation laws. You've seen them before. So this just tells us that the flow of charge out of a region is the rate of change of the charge in the region with a minus sign because it's flowing out. This is called the law of current conservation and is always true. Now, under those circumstances, with that understanding about the current, let's try to find out what the force is on a wire carrying a current. Suppose that this is a piece of wire which has an area across it, a little area A, and which is carrying current at a density J. Now, how much electricity passes through the entire wire per second? That's easy. It's JA. And this is what we sometimes call I, which is the charge passing any point on the wire, or really more accurately, passing any cut of the wire, any cross-section of the wire, passing a cross-section of the wire per second. Coulombs per second, or amperes, is the way it's measured. So here's a current in a wire in terms of J. Now I'd like to find out if there's a magnetic field present, what the force would be. Suppose there's a magnetic field present, and then these particles, there's a lot of particles, say, moving, each one carrying a charge q, n per cubic centimeter, moving with velocity v. You're then moving this way with velocity v. Then there's a force that's this way. We'll worry about the signs and directions in a moment. If the magnetic field is this way, there's a force maybe this way, maybe that way. This way, v cross b. There's a force out from the blackboard, which is proportional to the b and to the v and to the q on each particle. But there are n particles per unit volume. So this nqv is just j. So we get jb is the force per unit volume on a current in any situation. And after you see what happened, it's the j cross b. You can almost see that. It's v cross b. It should have been. So it's nqv cross b, which is j cross b per unit volume. But in the case of a piece of wire, the total force on this thing, if we take a volume of one unit length this way, one unit this way, or let's say we take a length L, and the area is A, then the total force on the length L is equal to J cross B times L times the area. But J times area is the current, and so the force on a wire is I cross B per unit length. If L is the length of the wire, then the force on a wire of length L would be I cross B. You know, it's just a mathematical expression of something which is obvious, that if there's a force on the electrons moving freely, then there's a corresponding force on electrons moving in a wire. And here we have a wire in which we're going to force electrons to move by closing the switch on this battery. And this time I have a magnet here, which will move, which will push or pull on the wire. And you see it lifts it up, which is at right angles again to the direction of the magnet. It's hard to hold a magnet and push the switch at the same time. It's a heavy magnet. But we'll do it again. And it shoots it out. Now, I could reverse the current and see that it goes down. It's hard to make all the changes of connection. But do you see it's the same thing if I turn the whole picture around? So instead of turning the wire around, which is what we'll do to reverse the current, I'll just turn the magnet around, please. All right. Then it's easier. And you see it goes down when there's a current. So it goes at right angles to the direction of the thing just as it's supposed to go. All right, now, that's the law which determines the effects of a magnetic field on moving charges. Since there's a pull on the wire down or up, depending on the signs, when I put a magnet there, you would expect from action equal reaction, which, by the way, is a dangerous proposition in this field, as we'll see later, that there'll be a force on the magnet when the current goes through the wire. Well, that means then that the wire must have influence on the magnet, and it has itself then a magnetic field. It creates a magnetic field, and the problem is to discover the laws by which that field is, what the laws are, to determine the field which is created. You see, you first discovered what the effect of a field is on a current, and the next problem is, given a current, what field does it make? The answer to this question was determined experimentally by one of the most brilliant theoretical arguments with three critical experiments and a nice theoretical argument by Ampere. But we're going to cut corners on the history and simply say that we're going to say we know what the Maxwell equations are, which are the result, the sublimation of a large number of experiments, and that they are here. The equations that we're interested in are the two, the divergence of B equals zero, and C squared times the curl of B is the current density over epsilon zero. In the case that the situations are steady, that nothing is changing with time, that the currents, rather, are not changing with time. By the way, this is called magnetostatics because nothing is changing with time. But it's a very dangerous proposition because things are changing. In order to get a magnetic field at all, you must have motion, you must have currents, you must have something going on. And so there are a number of little points that come up every once in a while that are rather confusing because although it's called static, it isn't static, it's dynamic. It involves the motion of the charges. You don't get any field otherwise. But if we suppose that the value of J isn't changing, and that's what we mean by static, what would be more accurately called steady currents, currents which don't change with time, and nothing otherwise changing with time, we can take the other term in the Maxwell equation and erase it. So in the same way as we did with electrostatics for a while, we'll discuss the equations without the other term. And these are the pair of equations which determines the magnetic field. Before I proceed at all, I would like to point out something. If I take the divergence of both sides of this equation, the divergence of a curl is necessarily zero. And therefore, this equation can only make sense if the divergence of J is zero. In general, the divergence of J, which is the flow of charge out of a region, is not zero, but is minus d rho dt. And it is necessary to have the other term dE dt on there in order to keep the equation from being inconsistent in general. But we're dealing with a situation in which nothing is changing with time and when the currents are steady and so on. And so we suppose that the charge density is also not changing anywhere with time, that the currents aren't piling up charge somewhere, and that this is zero. So the steady case involves that every time derivative is zero and that the divergence of J is zero. Otherwise, we can't solve it. What that means is that the currents which are running in these wires must be completed. They can't go to charging up a condenser or to pile up somewhere, to pile up somewhere. There can't be any change in the charge density. We should, of course, immediately be able to go back later. We'll go back and we'll fix the thing up. It's a rather minor repair job that needed to put the extra term on. But the first thing to take is the simplest case, and that's what we'll take now. Now let's look at the equations and see what they mean. In the first one, is that the divergence of the B is zero. That means that if we take the analog to electricity that said that the divergence of E was minus rho over epsilon zero, we would say from this, a way of saying this is that there's no magnetic analog of electric charge, no magnetic charges. There's not going to be things from which the magnetic field springs in the same sense as the electric field springs from a charge. Magnetic fields are made from a different source, from currents. And they're not made from magnetic charges. You remember that this meant that field lines of electric field could only begin and end on charges. This means, then, that magnetic field lines can never begin or end. One way that this can happen is that the magnetic field lines close on themselves. Frighteningly enough, it's not the only way it can happen. There's a complicated situation in which there's only one magnetic field line in the whole world which goes around, 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 and finally, somewhere way off at infinity, it weakens and closes on itself. That's a rather complicated thing. So for children, we'll say the magnetic field line always come back and close on themselves, but they really don't. At any rate, they don't begin and end anywhere. They peter out at infinity, perhaps, but they don't begin and end anywhere. But the main point of it is that it's a differential equation that's true about B, and that it means there are no magnetic charges. There have been no magnetic charges discovered either. Otherwise, I would show you some other equation. Now, the next equation, which I've emphasized only applies if the divergence of J is zero. Let's try to find out what this one means. Now, here we have a new kind, which is not quite analogous, it's the other way around, to the electric equation where the curl of E was zero. That the curl of E was zero, we turned out to mean that the line integral of E around a closed path, the tangential component of E along a root, E dot ds, whichever way you want, around the closed path was zero. The reason for that, by the way, is that the integral around any closed path of any vector in general is equal to the surface integral. If there's a surface made to cover the line, is equal to the surface integral of the normal component of the curl of the vector. And just remind you then that since the curl of E is zero, it says that this line integral is zero. Well, this theorem that the line integral of a vector is the surface integral of a curl is a general theorem, which is true of any vector, and is just as true of the magnetic field as it is of the electric field, because it's a mathematical relationship. On the other hand, now we can substitute from our equations here a formula for the curl and obtain an interesting integral relationship. This is J sub n dA, or divided by C squared epsilon naught. And the integral of J sub n dA, you say, oh yeah, I know, that's equal to d rho dt. No, this is only a partial surface. It's for a closed surface that the integral of J dA is the charge leaving the volume per second. What this is the total amount of current that flows through the surface, the charge that passes through the surface per second. It's the same idea as there, but it's not a closed surface. But a better way to say this is, since this surface is anywhere around, let's call this line here that we did the integral on a loop, just for a word. Then instead of saying the charge passing through the surface whose boundary is the loop, it's an easier way to say the charge going through the loop. Okay, so this is a charge going through the loop per second. Of course, the formula that I have here now which from this end to this end is what I want. Oh, I forgot the C squared epsilon naught. The formula we have for B here is something like, in a certain sense, an analog of Gauss's law in the way we're going to use it. It isn't, of course, Gauss's law, because Gauss's law has to do with the divergence. This is Stokes' law, it's called Ampere's law in the case of electromagnetism, which we can use to get some answers if we can guess at the symmetries under various circumstances. Just as we use Gauss's law to partially solve problems, so we can use Ampere's law to partially solve problems when conditions are just right, that we can guess something else. That's not exactly this. You see, remember in the case of Gauss's law, that Gauss's law alone did not permit us to solve every problem. We had to solve in general the differential equations in order to solve the general problem. And in the same way, this won't enable us to solve every problem by itself, because it doesn't include the first equation. But we will be able, if we're willing to take a few guesses as to the distribution of the field, to find the field, and therefore it's a quick way to remember it. I will give two examples of this. The first example that I would like to give is of a straight wire. What is the field produced by a straight wire going right through here, of a very small area? And we talk about the field outside the wire. Hint, undoubtedly somebody's going to give you the problem of the field inside the wire. Anyhow, let's work out the field outside the wire. I'm going to suppose something which is not at all evident. But after it's true though, so what am I going to do? If this is the wire and the current's coming toward you, we're going to suppose that the field lines go around the wire in that direction, around. If you'll let me suppose that the field lines go around the wire, closed on themselves that way, then we can find out how strong the field is. Because I'll just take a circle. Oh, we also see from the symmetry of the thing that whatever the size of B is here, it's the same size here and the same size here and the same size here. So I can do the integral of B dot ds very easily. It's the magnitude of B times the distance, because the B doesn't change as I go around here. If R is the radius of the circle, then it's B times 2 pi R is this side. And what's this side? How much charge passes through this loop, this ring, per second? Here's the loop, or the hoop, going around the wire, and the charge which passes through per second is equal to the current I. So it's just I over C squared epsilon 0, and we find that B is equal to 4 pi C squared epsilon 0 Y4. Well, you can write it with a 2 in it, times 2I over R. It's the same formula. And that's the formula for the magnetic field around the wire. It goes around the wire and varies inversely as R. The The reason I wrote it this way is I can remember that 1 over 4 pi c square epsilon 0 is exactly 10 to the minus 7. Not approximately, but exactly. It's the definition of the unit system. And so you can see what someone has done to us historically. They have made us accumulate a whole lot of little factors because they got something wrong with the definitions of the powers of 10 that were used in the original definitions of the units. And so this is a sneaky way to correct the powers of 10, which got beaten around in the early history of the electricity. So it's a hard way to write 10 to the minus 7. Anyhow, here's formula for B. If you would like to make it in vector form, it takes a little fiddling around because the B is at right angles to the current and so on. And if I wrote a vector, I vector, would you appreciate what I mean? It's a vector in the direction of the current. Well, the B is not in that direction, but is equal to I cross the radial vector, R, well, a unit vector in the direction of the radius. If you think a long time, you'll find out that if a unit vector in the direction of radius is this way and I is this way, that makes B that way. So that's the right formula. So here's a better one now, over 2r times 10 to the minus 7. Or if you wish to be pedantic, you can write 1 over 4 pi c squared epsilon naught. Anyway, then we have a field from a wire which is inversely as R. Now, would you have the other wire up, please? We'll see that there's such a field by putting a current through one wire and seeing if it makes a force on another. Because according to this idea, when we put the current through one wire, it'll make a magnetic field which goes around, say this wire. And then this other wire in a vertical magnetic field will be pushed in or out. And remember the sign. It turns out that currents moving in parallel directions repel. Yeah, they repel. It's the same experiment you saw before, but Tom thought it would be better on a larger scale, so we made it on a larger scale. And when the currents are flowing in the same direction through the two wires, they repel. If you reverse the direction of the current in one of the wires, that reverses the direction of the magnetic field produced by that wire. And so it should now make the force the other way or attract. So when the currents are going in ups, I said it wrong. Parallel currents attract and opposite currents repel. I said it wrong. Which way the current goes here, you have to check the signs on the batteries, but it's right. Let's see, right now they attract. And right now, this wire is connected to something that's marked black over here, and this wire is also black, and it's good. So the currents are parallel, and they attract. Let me take one more example that can be analyzed by Gauss's, Ampere's law, we're going to get ready with that thing. If we allow some knowledge of the field, which we really don't have. Suppose that I make a coil of wires, which you see that one there, but I make a very much longer one compared to its diameter, which has altogether n turns. And the current is I. What's the magnetic field? We can't tell right away from the one law alone, but it does turn out that the magnetic field is large inside the coil and spreads out away from the coil and is very small out in this region. So if we grant that we know that, then we can get an approximate value for the field by taking the following line to do our line integral around, in which this line goes through the inside of the solenoid, so-called, where the unknown field is B, and this side goes on the outside where the field is supposedly infinitesimal, and it's narrow enough compared to the length that the contribution from these two regions doesn't count. So if L is the length of the solenoid, L is the length of the solenoid, then we have BL for the line integral around this funny loop. And then we have for the current going through this loop, you say I, because that's what's coming. But it's not I, it's I and I and I and I and I and I. This one marvelous thing is that we can use the same current again and again to build up the magnetic field. So it's N times I is the total amount of current which is flowing through there over C squared epsilon naught is the formula for the B from a solenoid. You can divide by L yourself and get the formula for B. Now, The thing to do is to remember this law rather than these things, because it's easy to get them, you see. This means that such a thing, a solenoid, will produce a magnetic field which will spring out of the ends in a way that's something like the magnet, and I'll explain the relation in a minute. But anyway, by making a solenoid like this, we get an effect which is similar to that of a magnet. You see, if I put a magnet here, there should be a sideways deflection one way or the other. Now I can quiet this thing down and put current through this thing, through the solenoid, to make the thing going around, and then close this to see what happens. And you see there's a sideways push on the thing, just like there would be if there were a magnet under there. So it's analogous to the push produced by this bar magnet on that on the electrons. The interesting thing is that I'm talking about magnetism as in these equations always produced by current. Nevertheless, at the very beginning, I showed you magnetism produced by a bar of iron. Whenever matter is involved in one of these situations, the situation is very complicated, as in the case of electricity with the dielectrics. We will therefore relieve ourselves of the complexity by not discussing the interior guts of matter in magnetism for quite a while, but to concentrate rather from now on electricity when the currents and charges are all known, and worry later about how these currents and charges and whatnot are distributed in materials. But I cannot help but explain what happens in the magnet so that you won't find a complete and absolute mystery, or at least the mystery will be the same mystery in another form. First of all, in this coil thing, how can we quickly understand why the force is sideways? It isn't really very hard. If you had a single coil turn and put a wire here, then this wire is attracted to the parallel, if the current is this way, to the parallel moving current, is repelled from the opposite moving current, and the net result of those two forces, one this way and one that way, is to push up, right? That's why it's that way. Now, the secret of a magnet is that there's circulating currents inside. The easiest way to understand a magnet is to suppose that near the surface there's a current spinning, just like there was in that coil. That would be nice, then we could understand exactly what it does from that current. But you all know that permanent currents in a magnet like that are unusual, unlikely, because there's supposed to be resistance for the motion of electrons. It is not that the current really goes around the outside of the magnet, but instead that there's a million tiny, weeny little rotating electrons inside. And it's spinning, the electron spins, and in so doing corresponds to a tiny circulating current. Now, one electron doesn't have much effect. I mean, it is true that another electron moving here is attracted more for the top and less for the bottom, and it sounds like nothing. But there are billions and billions of electrons in here, and the miracle is that in a very few substances, it's possible to make all the electrons, well, not all, no, a large fraction of the electrons spin in the same direction. In fact, one from every atom in here can be made to spin in the same direction. And so we have large numbers of electrons all spinning the same direction, all making a little current, and that's what makes it equivalent to the big coil over there. So it is true that magnetism is always generated by currents, that the currents inside a piece of iron magnet is simply the currents of a spinning electron. So we will now disregard, or no longer consider until some weeks from now, what's actually going on inside, and to discuss more particularly what goes on in magnetic materials. We'll forget about matter, and we'll say we have always to specify the currents, and we'll limit our magnetostatics to the situation in which the currents are all given. Now, this magnetic force and its dependence on velocity is a very strange beast, and it's interesting to try to understand it from a number of points of view, the odd directional relationships and the odd velocity dependence is odd. Can't think of another word fast enough. Now, however, when we think of it as the interaction of currents, like parallel currents attract, it is not so peculiar. It's only when we have the circulating current in a magnet pushed up against one going the other way. and that it's all the right-hand rules that go into defining the B through this equation and in finding out what the B does in its action in that equation. There are two right-hand rules involved, so you could change them both to left-hand without making a mistake, but I'd advise you to keep on the convention anyway. But I would like to explain a little, to discuss a little bit about the puzzle that there are magnetic forces and something about the way they go. In doing this, I would like to show that the magnetism and the electricity are not independent things, that magnetism and electricity form together some unit of some kind in nature. Although in the static case, the set of equations is completely separated and there's no apparent relationship between the electric and magnetic force, there is nevertheless in nature itself a very intimate relationship that arises from the principle of relativity. Historically, the principle of relativity was discovered after the magnetism. As a matter of fact, it's the knowledge of magnetism and electricity which ultimately led to the discovery of the principle of relativity. So what I'm doing is not to saying that, it's historically absolutely in reverse, but it nevertheless helps you to understand, since you already know something about relativity, some of the puzzles that are associated with the magnetic field. Now let me show what one of the puzzles might be. Here it represents a wire, which I magnify so you can see the cross-section. And in this wire, there's a certain density of positive charges. That's the protons in the material, say, the nuclei. And there's a certain density of negative charges, and that these are drifting because of the current. The density is rho minus, and they're drifting with a velocity u. Out here, we have a particle, a charge, q, and we want to find the force on it. Now first, the force of electricity is due to the total charge density. But the charge density, if I make it neutral, suppose that there were electrical forces, then there would be forces even on static charges and in the air and in other places or in other ways from inside conduction. The whole surface of this wire would get charged up and so on. So the net result is that the positive and negative charges will balance each other in the interior because of the electrical force. So this is a condition in the inside. So then there's no electrical force from a wire like this, if the wire is not charged. So there's no force on a stationary charge. But when the charge moves with velocity v, there's suddenly a force. Where? Why? There's a force due to the magnetism. And the force from the magnetism we can work out from the equations that we wrote over here. First of all, because rho minus is moving with a velocity u, let me suppose that I use the same velocity in both cases. It's going to make it a little bit easier to make the explanation. But you can generalize it yourself. But it's perfectly possible that the particle here was moving with the same velocity as the electrons inside. It'll make it a little easier to explain something. So let's take the case that they happen to be moving at the same velocity. But you can take a more general case. Now, what is the force? The force is B times Q times V with the right signs and so on. There's a B this way and a V this way and so on. Now, B is the total amount of electrical current in the wire times 2i over a lot of constants, 4 pi c squared epsilon 0. That's B. And then we multiply by QV. But the I is the charge density times the area of the wire times the velocity of the current in there, which I'm taking to be V also. So I get 4 pi c squared epsilon naught QV. Or just let me collect those V's and C's together just a moment. That's V squared over C squared. That's the force, and if you work it out, if your charge density rho minus represents a negative charge, it depends on how you define it, but if you consider it as electrons moving this way and electrons moving that way, it's negative. No, what I would like to do, of course, is to ride along with this moving charge, because then the charge will be stationary, but the wire will be moving. This, we've just got a force by magnetism, but now we have the problem as follows. Here's a charge which is at rest. with a cable that's rushing by it. And in that cable, there are electrons relative to the cable moving this way. What's going on? Why is there a force? You say, magnetic force. No, because the charge is stationary, and there should be no magnetic force when a charge is stationary, when a stationary charge can only feel the electric field. This means that when a wire is roaring by in the opposite direction, and that contains at the same time a current, it must be charged. So we have to look into this. First of all, there would be a positive charge density, but moving in this direction, V. And then there would be the negative charge density standing still. But these are equal and opposite, and they cancel out. There's no electric field. There's a magnetic field, but who cares? The charge is something's the matter. Doesn't work. Oh, we have assumed that the charge densities are the same as they were before. But you have to watch out in relativity, of course, to find out whether the charge densities are the same as they were before. So the thing we have to discuss is whether what relation these charge densities would bear to the other charge densities according to relativity. Now, in order to do that, we have to find out what happens to electric charge, Q, of a moving charge. Suppose that we have an object which is moving rapidly. Is its charge changed? For instance, its mass is changed when it moves with the 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Question, is the charge bigger? Is the charge smaller? Is the charge the same? Answer, the charge is the same exactly, whether it's moving or not. How do I know? If you take a block of material, you know that the charges are moving inside, and yet the thing is completely neutral. Well, that could happen. Maybe there's a difference in bound. But suppose that I change the motion, the speeds of, say, the electrons, but not the proton. Then if the charge on each electron depended on its mean square, on its mean speed, and I changed those speeds, then the thing would become charged. So we could expect, therefore, that if we have some way to change the energy of the electrons in a material, it will charge up, or plus or minus, if the charge depends on velocity in any way. But it's very easy to make a change in the energy of electrons. For instance, in a chemical reaction between carbon and oxygen, the energy of the electrons is altered after the reaction. It's a different energy. But so the speeds of the electrons are altered, and the charge of the whole object would be changed. And there would be, therefore, associated with every chemical reaction, a generation or loss of charge. As we've emphasized a number of times, the balance between the positive and negative charge is so perfect. Otherwise, the force would be enormous. As a matter of fact, a little calculation will show that even in the simplest chemical reaction, the amount of charge that would be developed and the fields that would be produced are enormous, and that there's no evidence for such things. And so we know that the electric charge on a single particle, this electric charge, is unchanged when the thing moves. The total charge is the same. However, the charge density of a block of material is not unchanged, and the reason is the following. Suppose that we have in this wire cut out a cylinder of length L and of stuff which is standing still. Let rho zero be the charge density of an object standing still of length L. So and so many particles in here. Now it moves, and when it moves, as you know, it appears to be shorter. The new L is shorter by the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. But the total and the perpendicular distances are unchanged, so the area is the same. But the number total charge inside must be the same, and therefore the same charge in a smaller volume. Therefore, the charge, if the velocity of motion is v, the charge of a moving thing is equal to the charge of the thing at rest. I'm sorry, the charge density of a moving thing is the charge density of an object at rest divided by 1 over v squared minus 1 over square root of v squared over c squared. All right. Now we have to play this game back and forth here. First, rho prime plus. That's the easy one. That's equal to rho plus times the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. What about rho prime minus? That's the exact opposite, because this is the stationary case, and that's the moving case. You see, this tells us that rho minus is rho minus prime over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, that formula. because rho minus prime is the stationary charge density. And therefore, rho minus prime, by using that equation in the other direction, is rho minus over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Now you see that one of the charge densities is reduced and the other is enhanced. And the net result is that there's a resulting charge density. You see, they were equal before, rho plus and rho minus. But after these modifications, they're no longer equal. And in fact, the charge density rho would be rho plus prime minus rho minus prime. And if you work that out, or rho plus rather, and rho plus and rho minus are equal and opposite. So it's rho plus times, let's say it's rho minus, times minus the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared plus 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, which, if I multiply it all out, becomes 1 minus as v squared over c squared. Okay, now we have an electrostatic problem. We have here a cylinder with a charge density, a net charge density, given by rho minus v squared over c squared square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And their force then will be on here because of the charge density. So what is the force on a outside a long wire with a uniform charge density? We've worked out the field outside of a long wire. The electric field times Q, which would be the force, will be Q times twice the charge on the wire, which is the charge density times the area, divided by 4 pi epsilon 0. Now substituting for the charge density, this complicated expression, we get Q times 2 rho minus v squared over c squared over 4 pi epsilon 0 times the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, which is almost identical to the result obtained here. If you get the signs right, it's even right with the signs. The reason it isn't identical, it has a square root instead of this, is, of course, that there's also a transformation of the force. Force is the, in this case, is the rate of change of the transverse momentum per second. And transverse momentum is the same in the two coordinate systems. But the time is different, and that has to do with the square root. But if you'll take the limiting case of small velocities at least, and forget about it for a moment, then you see that we've understood the magnetism. In this case, it got the same result by working it out as an electrostatic problem and adding the principle of relativity. So you see that magnetism is required to be, well, isn't it required, because maybe relativity isn't right. But magnetism, in conjunction with electricity, completes the relativistic invariance of electrical law. If you wish to make this, if you're unsatisfied with this analysis because I use the same velocity in these two cases and would like to take a more general case, I'll tell you something interesting to help you to make the analysis a little shorter. And that is this. The charge density at rest, we call rho zero. Then we notice that the charge density in motion was rho zero over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And the current density in motion is rho v, and is therefore rho 0 v over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Now, if you look, for example, at two quantities which we of a moving particle like energy, its energy and its momentum, you see that its energy is 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, and its momentum is v over the square root. That is to say, a quantity 1 over the square root and v over a square root forms together a 4 vector, in which the 1 over the square root is like the time component and the v over the square root is like the space component. So therefore, the charge density rho and the current density j forms a 4 vector. This will permit you then to make a transformation from any coordinate system to any other coordinate system moving, say, with a velocity u in the z direction, by taking it to be exactly analogous to the Lorentz transformation in which the time is given by something and the new x is given by something we've seen before. By mere substitution that the time was replaced by the time component of the 4 vector current density charge density. In this case, the time component is rho. And the space component is j. And the x is replaced then by jx and so on, just like we did with momentum. The whole thing can be summarized, what's on that blackboard, by one word, by one sentence. Rho and J form a four vector. Now, I'd like to begin to analyze the question of analyzing these equations to find out how to find the charge and circumstances, how to find the field and circumstances in which the current density is given. But there's no simple symmetry associated with it. In other words, I want to solve this pair of equations here. Let me get them down here to look at them. I want to solve divergence B equals 0 and curl B equals J, given J, but mathematically rather than just by some kind of guessing. The first equation says that the divergence of B is 0. We can easily say, immediately, you see, when we had the case that the curl of E was 0, we know immediately that means that E is the gradient of a vector. And we wrote minus grad phi. Well, now, if we have the divergence of a vector is 0, we know that that implies that the vector is the curl of some other vector. And we call that vector A. In fact, it's important enough to have a name. It's called the vector potential. It's the analog of this other potential, which is called the scalar potential. So we know that B is curl of some vector A. Now, in the case of the scalar potential, we could use another potential which differed by the one by a constant, because in taking the gradients, nothing made any difference if you added a constant. Now, the question of interest and a quite complicated question is, can another vector, A prime, produce the same magnetic field? He woke up, I guess. Can the other vector, A prime, produce the same magnetic field? Can we arrange that curl A prime equal B and curl A equal B and have the two, A and A prime, not equal? Say they differ by a constant. Yes, but they can differ by more than a constant. For if I subtract these two equations, I deduce that the curl of A prime minus A is equal to 0. I must only make sure that the difference of the two vectors has 0 curl, naturally. Oh, well, if the thing has a 0 curl, then it must be the gradient of a scalar. And therefore, you see, the vector potential is not unique. One man may use one vector potential, say A, and another man may use A prime. If they differ only by a gradient, it won't make any difference. This freedom in A permits us to choose some other property of A to simplify the equations if we like. And I am going to make a choice. I'm going to choose, to help to define A, the condition that the divergence of A is 0. Suppose it weren't. And I try to find a new A prime so that the divergence is 0. Then it will be the divergence of A plus the divergence of the gradient of chi. Now, if the divergence of A weren't 0, you can always solve the equation Laplacian chi equal minus divergence A. It's like an electrostatic equation, to find the chi. Nobody's ever going to bother to solve it. The only thing I'm doing here is prove to you that I can always choose the divergence of A equals 0. Now, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take B. I can choose anything I want, but this is what I like to choose. I have B as curl A, and I choose the divergence 0. Now I will substitute this into the second equation here and find out what A has to do. I find that the curl of B, which is the curl of the curl of A, must be J over C squared epsilon 0. Now, we worked out this with is A, B, C, so to speak, back cab business. Anyhow, this is the gradient of the divergence of A minus the Laplacian of A, which is equal to J over C squared epsilon 0. The divergence of A is 0 by choice. And so we find that the problem that we have to solve is this one. Laplacian of A is equal to minus J over C squared epsilon 0. You know what that means? That means that the Laplacian of A sub x is equal to minus J sub x over C squared epsilon 0 to the positive a sub y is minus j y is on. Incidentally, we've been sick and tired of solving this one. And so we have the same problem again. Only what this means is that you can find the vector potential x component by working on the electrostatics problem by analogy, in which the x component of the electrical current replaces the charge and a sub x replaces phi plus 1 over times 1 over c squared. There's an old story about this may not be the easiest way to solve the magnetic problems, but what's good about it is it's the same as the electrical problems. And in fact, for example, a sub x at point 1 is equal to the j sub x at point 2 over the distance r12 times v2 over 4 pi epsilon naught c square, and so on. All the analog equations of electricity are right. This may not be the easiest way, but it's the same as the one in electricity, and reminds us, of course, of a famous story about a mathematician, the definition of a mathematician or the character of a mathematician. He's given a problem. He goes into a room. He wants to boil some water, and there's a kettle here and a stove here, but the kettle is empty, but the sink is way over there. So he thinks about it a long time. He figures in order to boil the water, he's got to get water into the kettle and so on. Takes the kettle over to the sink, fills it with water, very brilliant man, carries it back to the stove and puts it on the stove. Next day he comes in and the kettle is next to the sink. Comes in and thinks about it a while and says, aha. So he picks up the empty kettle and carries it over to the table and says, that's fine. Now I can solve the problem. It's the same as I solved yesterday. So this is the same as we solved before and is therefore the most convenient way for us to represent magnetism. Thank you. Yes.
Why is the field outside the solenoid very easy to understand?
That's not so easy to understand. I can't think of an easy way to explain it. I mean, I don't understand it too well myself. It's got something to do with... Yeah, the best way, one way I can see it, is to take a case where it's exactly zero, which will help a little bit. If you had a uniform sheet of current going this way, then it makes a magnetic field this way. And then you have another uniform sheet coming back the other way. And it makes a corresponding field. And they cancel on the outside. So just like with a condenser, with plus and minus charges, so with plus and minus currents on two sheets, it exactly cancels. Now a solenoid isn't exactly two sheets because it doesn't go to infinity, but it curves around. And it's the effect of the field produced at the top by the ones going this way at the top is canceled by the field at the bottom going the other way. But it's not obvious that the cancellation should be exact or anything, and that I did find the answer in a cheaty form. We can only really find it when we have the complete equations, which we're going to have here, and I'll do it next time, and then you can find out what the field would be exactly if you needed to. For instance, for a finite solenoid, it's not zero. It's a little bit. But it's a cheat. It's just an easy way to remember the results.
You said the moving charge, magnetic field has a force in it.
Right.
Now, what do you mean motion with respect to
it? Respect to you. And the magnetic field is respect to you. Now, the magnetic field is then not something which is perfectly definite. In fact, in this case here, well, it was the field, in fact, reversed in that case. But if you have a moving charge is moving in a pipe. Let's say a uniform density of charge running along in a pipe, not with a positive charge to cancel it, just running. Then you have a current and you have a magnetic field, and even another charge here, when moving along with it, would be attracted. All right? Now, if you stop the whole picture, in other words, you ride along with it, then there's no magnetic field, it's only an electrostatic problem. So a magnetic field is not something absolute. It may exist from one man's point of view, but not from another. In a moving system, the magnetic field appears different than it does in a still system.
In the examples you used, you took, first of all, a magnetic field that was stationary and a charge that was moving it.
Yeah.
And you said that then there was a force on the charge because of the magnetic field.
Right.
Then you took the stationary charge and the moving magnetic field, which would have been the same as moving yourself in the opposite
direction.
Yes,
but I moving magnetic field is, when a magnet moves, it creates an electric field.
He's talking about the wire moving back. You didn't say there was a magnetic field moving by. You just said the wire was moving.
That's right. I didn't say anything about the field moving. I have here a wire, and there's a certain science in the field. In fact, however, the field is the magnetic field is the same in this case.
Reverse.
Which? Oh, did I do it backwards, damn it? Of course. Yes, and I got the wrong side, too, when I was finished. No, but I knew I had the wrong side because I did it carefully at home before, and it was coming out wrong.
That makes an excellent oral exam. I've never used it.
No, but let me answer the fellow's question. You can have a circumstance in which in one point of view there's a magnetic field, and then when you ride along there is no magnetic field. But there's an electric field instead. There's no such a thing as a special law for a moving magnetic field. A moving magnetic field doesn't mean anything. A changing magnetic field means that the field is changing from point to point, but you can't say that it moves. If you move an object which creates a magnetic field, you have a magnet which is rolling down like this. If the magnet rolls by, there's an electric field at the moment that it comes by. The lines of force are not tied to the magnet, they're not going around. There is a force on this charge here, but it's due to an electric field produced by a moving magnet, something we haven't discussed. It's still there, but it's changed somewhat. It depends.
Your frame of reference, it's like rotation on a phonograph disc. You look at it at one point, it's rotating.
It's not easy. I mean, it's a surprising thing, but the magnetic, in a case of a magnet, because it starts by being neutral, the magnetic field is almost exactly the same when it's rolling as when it's not, but it's in addition, it's created an electric field. And the electric field that's created with a moving magnet is what attracts the charge.
And what are you taking measurements with respect to?
You make up your mind one way or the other, and you get two different answers, and I'll try to explain. First, if this is not moving and this is moving, relative to the ground, then there's no electric field in this case. There's only a magnetic field, and the motion of this charge through this field produces a force. Okay?
Okay.
Case two. The magnet is rolling or moving, and the fact that it's spinning has nothing to do with it. The magnet is moving, and this point is standing still. Relative to what? Well, there's some other point of view. Then, under those circumstances, there's a magnetic field from the magnet, but it's irrelevant because the force on this thing through the magnetism is zero because it has zero velocity. But when a magnet moves, there's an electric field produced. And the electric field, which we haven't learned about yet, but the electric field produced when a magnet is moving is what pushes on this charge.
Are you saying that the final result is the same thing?
Exactly.
Well, I can see that, but I can't really see the difference in between the causes of the final result.
Well, they're different. You see, you can't say that the force is produced by a magnetic field or the force is produced by an electric field and have that to be an absolutely meaningful thing. When you're in a moving system, the proportions of force which you claim are produced by electric field and magnetic field are different.
It seems that the only thing this depends on is whether or not you're moving.
And you get the same.
Like in all relativity, the answers you get depend on what you call energy and what you call momentum.
Wait a minute. The phenomena don't make any difference, right? Yeah. As this thing comes by, it flies up, okay? Now, as this thing rolls by, the electric field will turn out as this way, and as this thing rolls by, it moves up. And if you looked at it the other way, it would be the same. And that's the only thing that counts.
Yeah.
Now, so in this case, you ask yourself, but you still say to me, well, the force, is it due to a magnetic field or an electric field? Depends on the point of view. From one point of view, it's one. From another point of view, another. But to say that a force is due to an electric field in an absolute physical sense is a nonsense, or due to a magnetic field only, because when we get into the moving systems, the proportions change.
In other words, you can say that if there was an observer just standing there still, he'd say, give one answer.
To this question, that's right, exactly.
Else were moving, he'd give
You've got it, that's right. And so magnetism and electricity are really two aspects of exactly the same thing, the forces between charges. And some, depending on how the thing is moving, we resolve them in different proportions. You see, the E and B is really a separation of the two pieces of something which belongs together. Something like energy and momentum.
in a moving object, the energy of a, you say here's an object moving, it's got a lot of energy because of its kinetic energy, right? But if I'm moving with it, it doesn't have it. And it has momentum too, but it doesn't have the momentum when I'm moving. Well, does it have momentum or doesn't it have momentum? It depends upon how, whether you're moving with it or not, and on your point of view. So just like momentum and energy get mixed up, so electric and magnetic fields get mixed up, so to speak, as when you move.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and this example that I made here was meant to be an example in which here the force has its origin magnetic, but in the moving system, the force has its origin electrical. But it's the same phenomenon, and that's all that really counts.
If you and the charge and the wire were the only things in the universe,
yes.
And would it, considering that it's impossible to detect absolute velocity,
yes.
Would you be able to tell the difference?
No. That's why, that's the whole point of this discussion. You see, here's as a force, electrical force. And in a moving system, there's no more electrical force because the charges balance out, but there must be a new kind of force in order to get exactly the same phenomenon, in order to be not to be able to tell the difference. And so we call it magnetic, but the magnetic forces are not something that's absolute. You say, this is magnetism, because it depends on whether you're moving or not.
Generating
a magnetic field, those magnetic lines of flux in general
fall along equipatential surfaces.
What equipotential surfaces? What E-field? Say it again.
There's a wire, current in the wire.
Right. There's no E-field. The charges are neutral lies. However, the following is true, if it'll help you any. If you took away the protons and just had the electrons moving in a sort of ghost-like form, all right, without the matter, then there'd be a terrific electric field, of course, from the electron. Then you're right. Then the magnetic lines go along the equipotentials of the electric lines. In that one case of a uniform cylinder, whether it's generally true or not, I am off. I have to think a while.
In another case, if you stop the current, it allows some electrons to pile up in the wire.
Well, that's another question. We'll have to come to those.
But in that case, the equipotential surface is produced to be in the same places.
There's no longer any equipotential surfaces in the strict definition when you have things changing with time. We have to come to that. No, there's no secret shortcut of that kind. Okay.